Hello and welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from Religion News Service, from the Washington Post, from the Associated Press, and more. This program is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. The contents of this program are intended for people who are blind and print impaired. We begin this week's edition of Religion in the News with an article from Religion News Service dated November 21st. This is a commentary by Noam E. Marantz, who is listed as he's a rabbi listed as the American Jewish Committee's Director of Interreligious and Intergroup Relations. It's also noted the views expressed in this commentary do not necessarily reflect those of Religion News Service. This is titled, How the Infamous Oberammergau Passion Play is Evolving. The Oberammergau Passion Play, performed decennially in Germany's Bavaria since 1634, was, until relatively recently, believed to be irredeemably anti-Semitic. Jews were portrayed in words, costumes, and mannerisms as greedy, bloodthirsty, devilish, and legalistic. Jesus was Christian, and the Jews killed the Messiah, the Son of God. Adolf Hitler saw the play in 1930 and in 1934, the play's 300th anniversary, and cynically understood it as an irresistible tool in his path toward demonization, deportation, and destruction of the Jewish people. In praising the play, he proclaimed, "Never has the menace of Jewry been so convincingly portrayed." The Holocaust and subsequent Christian institutional self-reflection should have been enough to change the negative tide in Oberammergau. In 1965, Nostra Aetate, a declaration of the Catholic Church's Second Vatican Council, rejected collective Jewish guilt in the death of Jesus. It taught that Jews should not be presented as rejected or accursed by God, as if this followed from the Holy Scriptures. But change came slowly to Oberammergau. My organization, the American Jewish Committee, and other Jewish organizations demanded change in the past decades, but Oberammergau's leadership was resistant. As late as 1980, Rabbi Mark Tannenbaum, then the AJC's interreligious affairs director, called Oberammergau's passion one of the most anti-Semitic presentations anywhere in the world. Progress began in 1987, two generations after the Holocaust and one generation after Nostra Aetate, when Christian Stückel, a native of Oberammergau and founder of a local theater company, was elected to direct Oberammergau's main event. Still in his mid-20s, he began transforming the play and using its path toward rehabilitation as a vehicle for addressing Germany's anti-Semitic past. By 2010, Stückel had already eliminated the most heinous anti-Jewish excesses from the play and introduced a Jewish Jesus, who holds aloft a Torah facsimile and leads hundreds of Oberammergau residents in Hebrew singing of an original composition of the Jewish prayer Shema Yisrael. The portrayal of Jesus as unequivocally Jewish does make a difference. Christian embrace of Jesus' Jewishness has contributed mightily to the diminution of anti-Judaism and anti-Semitism. As Pope Francis has said many times in different ways, anti-Semitism is a sin and irrationally unchristian, given Christianity's Jewish roots and Jesus' Jewishness. Why does the Oberammergau Passion Play matter? For one thing, it is seen by 500,000 people during its 100 performance seasons. As the largest and longest running of all passion plays, too, it influences a worldwide genre that spawned anti-Jewish attitudes and violence over centuries. Moreover, the Bavarian venue, where the Nazi Party had flourished, magnifies the play's significance as Germany continues to grapple with its darker past, working to prevent anti-Semitism from reemerging. The 2010 play was not perfect in eliminating all anti-Jewish tropes, but we dare not let the perfect be the enemy of progress. Stückel is a receptive partner who welcomes input, both affirming and challenging, aimed at assuring historically accurate portrayals of first-century Roman and Jewish leadership and power. With the full cooperation of the Oberammergau leadership, AJC has convened an academic advisory group that is consulting with Stückel and his team as they continue to address lingering anti-Jewish tropes in the play. Earlier this year, the advisory group met in the U.S. with the Oberammergau's play's visiting leadership, and in mid-November, the group traveled to Oberammergau for a three-day site visit to view the 2020 costumes and sets and to comment on the 2020 script evolution. Time to coincide with the visit, AJC launched a website dedicated to understanding Oberammergau in the context of Christian-Jewish relations. Further progress in revising the play will make clear that the Jews did not kill Jesus. It will counteract the implausible assertion that Caiaphas, the high priest, could have demanded and dictated that the disproportionately more powerful Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, crucify Jesus. When the Roman Catholic Archbishop of New York, Timothy Dolan, now a cardinal, saw the play with AJC in 2010, he said that Oberammergau is a paradigm for the friendship of Jews and Catholics. It has shown low points in their relations in the past, but now it has become a sign also of great progress. That is an aspiration both Christians and Jews can embrace. We'll turn next to an article from the Washington Post dated November 19th. This is titled, How Kanye West Put Joel Osteen's Prosperity Gospel Back Under the Spotlight. And this article is written by Sarah Pulliam Bailey of the Washington Post. A performance by artist Kanye West at Joel Osteen's Lakewood Church in Houston on Sunday has launched a debate among Christians over controversial prosperity gospel teachings and the role of race in conservative evangelical Christianity. Kanye West and Joel Osteen are a match made in market-driven heaven, said Jonathan L. Walton, dean of Wake Forest Divinity School, who noted how West sold $170 Jesus is King sweatshirts with his new album. Both have baptized their commercial notoriety and their financial gains in Jesus' name, Walton said. The communion table has become a merch table. West's recent album, Jesus is King, has earned praise in unusual corners of conservative Christianity. But his comments have raised eyebrows over their association with Osteen's prosperity gospel teachings, the idea that God grants health and wealth to his followers. Some Christians are also questioning whether black hip-hop artists are being used by white evangelical preachers to boost their own brand and falsely signal progressive racial attitudes. Jesus has won the victory. Now I told you about my arrogance and cockiness already. Now the greatest artist that God has ever created is now working for him, West told Osteen on Sunday. The prosperity gospel has seen a boost under President Trump, who has included in his administration the televangelist Paula White, who promotes these teachings. West and Osteen are part of a show-and-tell prosperity gospel movement in Christianity, which says that God uses people to show he blesses them, said Kate Bowler, author of the book Blessed, a history of the American prosperity gospel. Kanye's unbreakable confidence that he is the greatest artist on the planet could not have found a better theological home, Bowler said. Both Joel Osteen and Kanye West believe that God can best be seen when people are healthy, wealthy, happy, and successful, and they are pleased to point to their own careers as proof. West recently tied his success and wealth to his newfound faith in an interview with comedian James Corden on Carpool Karaoke. God is using me to show off, West told Corden. Last year I made $115 million and still ended up $35 million in debt. This year I looked up and I just got $68 million returned to me on my tax returns. During a 20-minute interview with Osteen during a regular Sunday morning church service, West said many Christians give Osteen a hard time, but when you turn on the radio, Osteen keeps showing you how good God is. When you've got Kanye defending you, you've made it, man, Osteen said while laughing. West's new album preempts criticism from fellow Christians. They'll be the first one to judge me, make it feel like nobody loved me, he sings in the song Hands On. During his interview with Osteen, West said that at his lowest point, when he was hospitalized in 2016 after a mental breakdown, God was there with me, sending me visions, inspiring me. His own acknowledgement of his recent mental health struggles has raised questions about the reasons behind his heightened interest in spirituality. Pastors need to be especially careful when featuring fame and conversion, said rap artist Kevin Burgess, better known by his stage name KB, who attended White's Without Walls Church 15 years ago, but now attends a small urban church in Tampa called Living Faith Bible Fellowship. What I do bristle at is the tendency superstar pastors have to stake their claim in superstar converts, sort of chomping at the bit to ride this wave of attention for the sake of strengthening your brand, he said. In recent years, white evangelicals have become especially interested in hip-hop artists who are Christians, including Lecrae, Shay Linney, and Tripp Lee, which has perhaps paved the way for many of them to embrace West's new work as well. I'm not sure people really love Kanye, said hip-hop artist Cho Baraka. They love the idea of him and how they can use him for their particular wars and agenda. In 2017, Baraka's album was pulled from Southern Baptist retailer Lifeway Christian Stores because it had the word penis in it. In contrast, many Southern Baptists have expressed appreciation for West's recent album. I think there's more grace for artists who start in mainstream markets and find themselves moving to the Christian market, Baraka said. While some evangelicals have reservations about Osteen's theological teachings, many have embraced West as a brand since his recent album release. The American Bible Society has given away 11,000 free Bibles because of the high interest since West's album release. Evangelical culture in America is very fame-driven, said Derwin L. Gray, pastor of the non-denominational megachurch Transformation Church near Charlotte and a former NFL player. It has the propensity to use people instead of to develop people. West and evangelicals hold a mutually beneficial relationship, said Ibram X. Kendi, a historian at American University and author of How to Be an Anti-Racist. White evangelicals are showering him with attention because they've been criticized for years for their racism, Kendi said. Anytime they can embrace a person of color, it allows them to present themselves as not racist. West has been tied to the Pentecostal tradition for several years and was married to Kardashian by Florida Pentecostal preacher Rich Wilkerson Jr. in 2014. But recently, West appears to be receiving input from predominantly white evangelical leaders, including Adam Tyson, who teaches biblical counseling at the Masters University in California and is pastor of a small Bible church there. Tyson, who declined to comment on West's appearance there, received his master's degree from the Masters Seminary. That seminary, known for its theological conservatism, was founded by John MacArthur, who recently made comments criticizing popular Bible teacher Beth Moore and whether women should preach. Tyson told Christianity Today magazine earlier this year that an employee of West attends his church and invited the musician to attend his small Bible church, and he did. The pastor later flew to Wyoming to conduct a Bible study for West and his employees. Tyson has preached at Sunday services, the worship-like concerts West has put on since earlier this year. West's support for Trump and comments that slavery was a choice has shaped many people's opinions, especially those of African Americans, about his recent conversion. Atlanta pastor Jamal Bryant recently condemned West's positions as harmful after West appeared at his church in September. The reaction to West has been polarizing among Christians, said Esau McCauley, a professor of New Testament at Wheaton College. People think he's either the devil or he's leading a revival, McCauley said. I think he's neither. He's a troubled person trying to find healing in Christianity. Some black church leaders are worried that the white evangelical leaders who are connected to West won't push him to question his support for Trump. Some black pastors say, we wanted him to get the right Jesus, not the white Jesus, said Charlie Dates, pastor of Progressive Baptist Church, a historically black church in Chicago attended by about 800 people weekly. But Dates believes that West's recent album will transcend Kanye West as a brand. The gospel message itself has inherent power, said Dates, who was involved in a private event earlier this year with West. We should not confuse the potency of the message with the unpredictability of the messenger. Osteen's Lakewood may have been the biggest church West has been in, but he has also made appearance at the Fellowship Missionary Baptist Church on Chicago's South Side, the Forum in Los Angeles, Howard University, and the Greater Allen AME Cathedral of New York in Queens. Ahead of his appearance at Lakewood, West also held two services for prisoners at the Harris County Jail in Houston on Friday. Jason Spencer, Public Affairs Director of the Harris County Sheriff's Office, tweeted a picture of the service. We'll return to Religion News Service for our next article on religion in the news this week. This article is a commentary entitled, People of Faith Are Heard Online, But the Partisans Are Winning. And this commentary is by Ryan Burge of Religion News Service. As the impeachment hearings proceed on Capitol Hill, it's astonishing to follow the reactions to the developments on social media, where the constant stream of tweets, likes, comments, and shares is apparently further polarizing the American electorate. Watching this action, I began to question how the social media torrent is affecting people of faith. To get a sense of this, I took a look at a battery of five questions from the Cooperative Congressional Election Study, which was put into the field in the fall of 2018. It asked respondents if they have done any of the following on social media. Number one, posted a story, photo, video, or link about politics. Number two, posted a comment about politics. Number three, read a story or watched a video about politics. Number four, followed a political event. Number five, forwarded a story, photo, video, or link about politics to friends. First, who is more active on social media? One would assume that the world of the internet would be dominated by the young, as they are often the first to adopt new technologies. However, the data here tells a completely different story. By and large, the people who are clogging up your news feed with political stories are some of the oldest Americans, although which older Americans are most active can depend on their religious affiliation. For instance, white evangelicals in their mid-40s or older are slightly more likely to say they've engaged in the activities listed above than the youngest white evangelicals. The same is essentially true of white mainline Protestants and Catholics. The pattern breaks down only among older non-white Americans in these traditions who spend less time on social media than their white peers. Mormons follow a distinct pattern of their own. Social media use is basically flat across the middle of the age spectrum, but the oldest Mormons are extremely active on the internet, engaging in nearly 3 out of 5 of the listed activities. The only other group that competes with the oldest Mormon social media usage are the oldest atheists, who engage in 3 of the listed activities. Agnostics are not far behind. But a more important question is this: does the phenomenon known as the spiral of silence extend to the digital sphere? The spiral of silence refers to the tendency for people who see that their opinions are in the minority in a social situation to be reluctant to voice their dissent to the group. The rest of the group members, meanwhile, assume that silence equals agreement. I suspected that the spiral of silence is operating among many politically homogenous religious groups, namely those white evangelicals on the right and atheists on the left. To test my theory, I looked at just one question from the social media battery. What percentage of each religious group, broken down by Republicans and Democrats, posted a story on social media, thereby breaking their silence? Though not a lot of differences exist between partisans of any religious group, I did find that Democratic mainline Protestants are more likely to share than Republican mainliners, and that atheist and agnostic Democrats are also somewhat more active on social media than their Republican counterparts. The differences, however, are fewer than 10 percentage points. This indicates that people are more willing to share their political opinions even if they are in the political minority among their religious tradition. But on looking further, the reason for this is disheartening. After matching people's activity on social media with their approval of President Trump, I broke the sample into Republicans and Democrats across 16 religious categories and visualized the outcome. It turns out that the more polarized one's view is of Donald Trump, the more active one is on social media. That's true for all Protestants and Catholics in the sample. The most active Republicans on social media have nearly 100% approval of Donald Trump, while the line for Democrats is either flat or downward, meaning at best social media behavior is not pushing them further to the left. This gives some support to the spiral of silence still existing in the digital sphere. The most active in your newsfeed are the most die-hard for their party. Put another way, the moderates are staying on the sidelines. The trends hold for religiously unaffiliated and atheist Republicans as well. The more active on social media, the stronger the support for the president. The picture that emerges here won't come as a surprise to many who spend time on Twitter. Social media is a partisan hellscape dominated by people who see few shades of gray in American politics. But if there is good news, it's that apart from the religious true believers of both parties, there is a silent majority, likely filled with political pragmatists, who see good in both political parties. My friend and colleague Amanda Friesen once told me about a focus group she was conducting in which she asked why the loudest voices in American politics are also the most extreme. One participant answered simply, "Moderates don't march." It seems that they don't tweet or post on Facebook either. Our next article is technically from Religion News Service, but was published to the Associated Press Wire, and that's where we picked it up from. This is by Yonat Shimron of Religion News Service, and the title, "The Cost of Coming Forward, One Survivor's Life After #MeToo." This is Dateline Greensboro, North Carolina. Megan Lively glanced down furtively to the copious notes she had jotted in a thick spiral-bound notebook resting in her lap. She was about to speak to a room full of Southern Baptist pastors about the sexual abuse she experienced, and she was nervous. Her message to more than 50 male pastors sitting in a conference room during the annual meeting of the Baptist State Convention of North Carolina earlier this month was both tremulous and full of conviction. When a woman comes forward alleging abuse, listen to her. Don't try to fix it. Be more like Jesus. For Lively, speaking publicly about her sexual abuse 16 years ago on the campus of Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary is still stressful. It's been a year and a half since she revealed she was the woman who was encouraged by Paige Patterson, then president of the seminary, not to report her rape by a fellow student to the police. That allegation, cited by leaders of a Southern Baptist seminary, helped get Patterson, once a revered figure in the Southern Baptist Convention, fired as president of Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Fort Worth, Texas, last year. It also helped move the Southern Baptist Convention toward a reckoning with sex abuse. Lively, who is now married with two children and runs a social media consulting business for small and mid-sized churches, does not revel in the spotlight. In September, she spoke at the Caring Well conference, in which the denomination invited abuse survivors to tell their stories. In the new year, she plans to speak at half a dozen other SBC-affiliated venues. But public speaking is not a role she relishes. She has just emerged from a harrowing year in which she faced a trauma she had buried deep inside her for more than a decade. She'd much rather be known for her social media company, Relevant Reach. She also understands there's no turning back. "I'm willing to share what happened to me if it helps somebody else," Lively said. The multifaceted sexual abuse scandal within America's largest Protestant denomination has made household names of several Southern Baptist women who have come forward in recent years with stories of clergy misconduct and of church officials failing to respond. Lively, now 40, doesn't want that kind of recognition. "Contrary to what some may believe, I'm not a fan of the principles of the hashtag MeToo movement," she told pastors assembled at the abuse crisis panel in Greensboro last week. "I wasn't empowered or motivated by the MeToo movement or by a hashtag. I don't find power in women standing up and saying I was sexually assaulted. I grieve when that happens." Lively is trying to walk a middle path. She does not want to come off as an angry feminist trying to pull down powerful men. She was raised to respect her elders and look up to authority. She and her husband, Vincent Lively, are faithful churchgoers at Peace Church in her hometown of Wilson, North Carolina. Some of the people she most respects are Southern Baptist men. But after the dozens of reports of sexual abuse in the church, she also wants to help her denomination do the right thing. In this, she has become a reluctant speaker. Megan Lively felt a call to Christian ministry when she was 16. The daughter of a realtor and a psychologist, Lively grew up in Wilson, an old tobacco town about 40 miles east of Raleigh, the state capital. Her family attended Grace Baptist, and like them, she loved church. At Campbell University, she majored in religion and joined a group called Monday Night Bible Study, started by two Campbell graduates, J.D. Greer and Bruce Ashford. Greer is now president of the SBC. Ashford is now provost and dean of the faculty at Southeastern. After graduating from college, Lively wanted to continue studying Christianity, and in 2002 she enrolled at Southeastern to pursue a Master of Divinity degree in Women's Studies, a program started by Dorothy Patterson, Paige Patterson's wife. By then, Paige Patterson had already cemented his role as the architect of the Southern Baptist Convention's conservative turn with its embrace of biblical inerrancy, the belief that the Bible is without error. In 1992, Patterson was named president of Southeastern in Wake Forest, North Carolina. But he wasn't quite done. In 2000, Patterson and his wife led the SBC to revise its doctrinal statement to codify traditional gender roles. The revised statement now includes a sentence declaring that a wife is to submit herself graciously to the servant leadership of her husband, and another that declares the office of pastor is limited to men. Around that time, Dorothy Patterson started the master's program intended to educate women about their biblical role as wives and mothers. Lively, like many in the denomination, adored the Pattersons. As a woman, she knew she couldn't be a pastor, but her calling was not to preach from the pulpit anyway. Once on campus, she found the master's program was not as rigorously academic as she had hoped, and she was also one of only a handful of single women on campus. Still, she went to classes and studied. The following year, she began dating a student. Lively won't go into details about that fateful evening. It's still too raw. But the man she had been dating for a few weeks sexually assaulted her, she said. The following morning, she reported a non-consensual sex act to a campus student office. She was immediately called and questioned by Paige Patterson. She recalls him asking for the precise details and then suggesting she was at fault for inviting a male student to her room. She was asked to forgive her assailant and advised not to report it to the police. "I remember feeling very ashamed," she said. Southeastern placed Lively on probation. She can't remember why. It may have been for allowing the male student to her room. The school also took disciplinary action against her alleged attacker. With that, the matter appeared closed, and so, it seemed, was her call to ministry. During the 15 years that followed, Lively told no one what had happened. She withdrew from Southeastern to care for her ailing grandfather and took jobs in banking and marketing. She married Vincent, an insurance agent, and became a mother. The couple became members of Peace Church, a large congregation in Wilson, duly aligned with the Southern Baptist Convention and the National Association of Free Will Baptists. Then in the spring of 2018, while scrolling through her social media feed, Lively began to read about mounting criticisms of Paige Patterson. A recording surfaced of Patterson saying he counseled abused women to remain with their husbands. In a video, he was seen objectifying a teenage girl and criticizing the physical appearance of female seminary students. The story sparked flashbacks and mounting feelings of anger. One evening after Lively's son and daughter were asleep, she had an argument with her husband. He asked her what was wrong. She told him about the assault at Southeastern. "Megan, you were raped," he said. "No, I wasn't," she blurted out, still struggling with the denial. "I was still that little girl under the control of the Pattersons," she said later. But the flashbacks, insomnia, and anger she was experiencing were signs that what she had long repressed were coming back into focus. She contacted Bruce Ashford, now the Southeast Provost, to tell him what happened to her in 2003. He told her the seminary would support her if she wanted to press charges against her alleged assailant. Lively decided it was too late for that, though she supports other women who do. After the wife of Patterson's chief of staff published a blog post contesting Lively's account and quoting from a private letter Lively wrote to Patterson after the incident, Lively decided she didn't want to remain anonymous anymore. Lively has resumed her friendship with Daniel Aiken, the president of Southeastern, whom she first met in church revival as a teen and later during college. The two talk or text every few weeks. When she told him she would like to complete her degree, Aiken said the school would assume the cost of tuition. She understands that some people believe women who come forward with allegations of abuse are doing so for fame or fortune or to get back at someone. She feels bound to demonstrate that's not why she's doing it. But many days, she wishes she didn't have to. "I don't know of any little girl that dreams of growing up to be on this stage discussing this topic," she said, "but I believe God can use my broken story of redemption." And she adds, "Maybe the church can, too." We've reached the end of our time on Religion in the News for this week. We certainly do hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Brian LeBlanc, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. You can get podcasts of our broadcasts by visiting our website, available for download weekly at ncreadingservice.org. And we'll talk to you next time on Religion in the News.